Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest effort to scuttle the nomination of Senator Chuck Hagel to be Secretary of Defense with a full-page attack ad in Thursday's New York Times by the Log Cabin Republicans. A longtime Pentagon insider and designer of the A-10 and F-16 fighters, Pierre Spray, joins us to discuss why he thinks Hagel would be a bad choice and Michelle Flournoy or Ashton Carter even worse. Then, with the Tea Party all but shutting down the Congress and the ship of state heading over the fiscal cliff, we will speak with journalist and author Gary Weiss about the ideological underpinnings of the obstructionists and their billionaire backers. He is the author of Ayn Rand Nation, The Hidden Struggle for America's Soul, and we will discuss the wealthy acolytes of Ayn Rand who have taken over the Cato Institute and Freedom Works. Then finally, we will speak with Dina Racer about her article at Truthout, Slow-Rolling Massacre Unfolds in the Shadow of Shocking High-Profile Shooting Sprees, which explores the contrast between the intense media focus on the recent killing of schoolchildren in an affluent Connecticut neighborhood and what happens almost every day in poorer neighborhoods across America where school kids are gunned down with barely a mention in the press. I'm now speaking with Pierre Spray, who is a veteran high-tech defense weapons and systems designer, as well as a highly regarded producer of avant-garde jazz and other genre recordings. Pierre Spray was the primary designer of two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. He left the Pentagon in 1986 and went on to found Maple Shade Records. Welcome to Background Briefing, Pierre Spray.
Hey, Ian. Great to talk to you.
And today's Thursday's New York Times has a full-page ad featuring a picture of a very sinister-looking Senator Hagel, and the caption reads, "Chuck Hagel, wrong on gay rights, wrong on Iran, wrong on Israel. Tell President Obama that Chuck Hagel is wrong for Defense Secretary." And then, as a sort of afterthought, help us create a stronger and more inclusive Republican Party. Donate today to the Log Cabin Republicans. This is, of course, a part of a sustained attack on he's not an official nominee to become Secretary of Defense, but seems to be somebody that the White House has floated. What's your sense of this campaign, Pierre?
Well, this is so clearly fueled by the Israeli lobby, or I should say more precisely, the Likud lobby, because, of course, the Israeli lobby itself in America has changed a lot over the years and has become just an adjunct of right-wing Israeli politics, not of all Israelis and certainly not of all American supporters of Israel. But Chuck Hagel is, like the other two candidates, you know, guaranteed to be a terrible Secretary of Defense. The thing I like best about him is simply the people who attack him. And I'm almost tempted to say we should all back him just in order to hand those people a defeat, because it's quite outrageous between, you know, the simply obstructionist Republicans and the people who serve and kowtow to the Israeli lobby, who've been campaigning night and day against Hagel. It'd be wonderful to see them handed a defeat. But that's the last good thing I can say about appointing Hagel as Secretary of Defense.
Well, certainly people have come to Hagel's defense. A rabbi in his home state of Nebraska, the last four national security advisors wrote an open letter castigating the president for hanging these people out to dry and not appearing to stand by them, which seems to be a kind of MO of the White House, or at least of the Obama White House. It's hard to believe, though, that Obama, after he got rolled on his choice for Secretary of State, Susan Rice, that he would allow himself to be rolled again. Do you think he will?
I'd say it's more likely than not, simply because, you know, a very major portion of, you know, his campaign was leaning exactly on the same people who were attacking Hagel. You know, the Israeli lobby was a tremendously important component, particularly of his first campaign, and, of course, less so in the last campaign since the lobby elected to back, you know, whatever Bibi Netanyahu wanted. And obviously Bibi didn't care for Obama too much.
Well, then all the more reason Obama should stick by Hegel. But
well, he should, but my guess is that, you know, in his usual calculation of American political power balances over everything else, you'll see that there's no point in taking on the Israeli lobby over a Secretary of Defense. They'll all be, you know, they'll all be patsies, basically, for the military-industrial complex. So what difference does it make whether it's Hegel or Flournoy or, God help us, Ashton or Carter?
Well, it's certainly there is a pattern there with Obama, and apparently Obama himself thought that the Supreme Court was going to strike down his signature, which is the Affordable Care Act, the so-called Obamacare, which he's never sold. He's never stood by that, and he was even prepared for a defeat on that, and wasn't going to fight particularly. You know, he's apparently, once he decides that he doesn't want to spend political capital on a losing battle, he doesn't. The reason I'm talking to you, Pierre, is that you're actually not one of the crazy neocons and who brought us the Iraq disaster, but you have some objections to the nomination of Senator Chuck Hagel to be the Secretary of Defense.
Well, to be even-handed, let me tell you, I object equally to all three current candidates, or you know, said to be candidates. Hagel is a guy who was famous in the Senate for, you know, making a few kind of bold-sounding statements, including even some doubts as to whether we had to support Israel more than 98%, and who never, ever voted those convictions. You know, just a guy who make a bold statement, walk away from it, and vote against it. He came into the Congress supposedly representing the veterans, and that he would never let a veteran go to war again in some useless war because he experienced Vietnam himself. What happened? He voted for Kosovo. Not only did he vote for bombing in Kosovo, he voted for ground troops in Kosovo. He voted for Iraq. You know, he had made some statements about some doubts about Iraq. When the vote came around, he voted straight up and down the line for Bush and headlong into Iraq. He voted for Afghanistan. He voted for every increase in the defense budget every single year that happened on his watch. He voted for the Patriot Act, even after making nice statements about American rights. You know, I mean, this is a guy who, you know,
wants it both ways.
Simply doesn't stand up for anything. And his background, his business background, is, to say the least, very unsavory. So that doesn't add confidence to, you know, what he would do as Secretary of Defense, you know.
You mean because he was a part owner of a company that made voting machines?
Well, it's worse than that. I mean, you know, look, let's track his whole business history. He was a lobbyist for Firestone. He was a fundraiser for Reagan. He joined an investment kind of vulture capital company, and they were the ones who put up the money for this stealthy Republican operation to start a voting machine company, you know. And that was the voting machine company that later became known as Election Systems and Software, that turned out those really vulnerable to rigging voting machines that Ohio was so fed up with them, they actually sued the company. That's what shabby stuff they delivered. But that was very deliberate. You know, it wasn't an accident that he was the Republican head of an investment company that could put up that money, and he became the chairman and the CEO of that company in its founding. So, and today, what is he? He's on the board of Chevron, one of the smelliest of the oil companies. Not that there's much difference amongst them. And Deutsche Bank, you know, who's been involved in the most horrendous rip-offs on the financial market. He's on both boards. So you put a guy like that in as Secretary of Defense and you expect something good to happen?
Again, I'm speaking with Pierre Spray, who's a veteran high-tech defense weapons and systems designer, as well as a highly regarded producer of avant-garde jazz and other genre recordings. Pierre Spray was the primary designer of two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. He left the Pentagon in 1986 and went on to found Maple Shade Records. So let's turn to the other two, because there's a chance, right, as you've suggested, that Obama will cave, and to some extent that appears to be his MO. Let's turn to Michelle Flournoy. I was talking yesterday with Steve Clemens, who was on Hardball with Chris Matthews and was kind of upset by some of the MSNBC women babble on quite a bit. In this case, a woman called Crystal Ball and Karen Finney, who were saying how wonderful it would be to have a woman as Secretary of Defense. And Steve Clemens was complaining that they obviously don't know anything about this woman's record, that she's an absolute favorite of the military-industrial complex. In fact, she founded a group, a front group for the military-industrial complex.
Right. She's a very different kettle of fish than Chuck Hagel. She's somebody who's basically been a think tank policy wonk all her life. She's studied social studies. She hasn't the slightest idea which end of a rifle fires. You know, no idea of weapons, no idea of how to buy weapons, no idea how to manage them, and no idea of, you know, of what the real problems of armies are. She's simply, you know, how should I say, a gifted writer of policy wonkery, and that's what she's been doing all her life. She kind of built that that career into a deputy assistant secretary of defense position under Clinton, in which she did exactly the same thing, turned out endless reams of totally hopeless paper on strategy that had nothing to do with what anybody in the Pentagon did about people, about weapons, about organizing, about, you know, curing big problems in the Pentagon. It was just this endless ream of paper. Then she left again, went back to the world of policy wonks, started after being rising, you know, quite handily in Washington think tank. She started her own think tank, the Center for New American Security, that turned out to be a total propaganda front for Democratic policy wonks. She funneled a whole bunch of people through her center into the Pentagon. They got nice positions. She wrote a lot of propaganda on behalf of this ridiculous counterinsurgency, supposedly new strategy that Petraeus backed. She was a big, big backer of Petraeus, one of the biggest in Washington. And she parlayed all that into an Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in 2009 under Obama.
But her think tank wasn't it funded by big defense contractors?
It's not known. I'll tell you one thing. She refused to say who funded her, so so that's not a good sign. The really good think tanks that work on defense, there aren't many of them, very publicly state, we take no money from defense contractors. That's the only way to work on defense.
Sure, sure.
So since she refuses to say it, you can bet your bottom bippy she's getting lots of money from defense contractors.
Let's turn P.S. Bray, to Ashton Carter, unless there's something more egregious you have to report about this woman.
She's the classic policy apparatchik, and Ashton Carter is kind of her symmetrical dual. He's the classic high-tech policy wonk. He got a degree, a Ph.D. in physics, never did a lick in physics after that, and immediately joined the think tank world up around Harvard and the Kennedy School and MIT, and then rode that into a deputy assistant secretary position also under Clinton, doing all kinds of policy papers on nuclear proliferation, which is like an endless, useless morass, and a whole bunch of stuff about supposedly protecting, you know, the loose uranium in the former Soviet Union. He was deeply involved in that. That hasn't come out too well. And then he left there, you know, and joined the real hardcore high-tech advocacy world. He joined up with Bill Perry, who's been a shill for, you know, the high-tech defense industry and a big mover and shaker for high-tech in Democratic circles ever since President Carter.
Wasn't he one of the big proponents of stealth?
Of course. He was the inventor of stealth as a billion-dollar program. He didn't invent stealth at all.
No.
It existed under the Germans. But he turned it into a multi-billion-dollar program and a super-secret program that nobody could oversee.
Right, and it's been the biggest disaster in defense procurement because it's created these absolutely worthless airplanes.
Right, exactly. He's the author of that. And Ashton Carter went to work for that master.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about, again, Pierre Spray is a veteran high-tech defense weapons and systems designer and was the primary designer on two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. Now, the F-35, which is the biggest defense contract in history, it's mm-hmm. about 30% of all of the Pentagon's procurement. It's about, 1.6 to close to $2 trillion it's going to cost, and it's a complete dog, as is the F-22 that preceded it. And the F-35 is going to replace the plane that you designed, the F-16, and the F-16 outperforms it.
In every way. In every mission you could think of, the F-16 waxes it, And Ashton Carter is, in recent memory, in the last 5 years or so, is one of the principal architects of the cover-up for the F-35 disaster. He was the acquisition czar when the real, real openings came that showed the disasters in testing, the disasters in cost overrun, the lying that was going on about the program. And a lot of this was being discovered in the Pentagon, actually, by the managers of the program, the people who were testing it. They were all reporting this. The cost estimating people were saying that the costs being put forth by the program and by Lockheed were just, you know, ludicrous. And he was the guy who smoothed all of that over, fronted for the disaster, and kept it going, approved going forward instead of kind of stopping it, regrouping, recasting the program. He did a kind of phony reorganization of the program that didn't amount to a hill of beans and that kept the money flowing to Lockheed without interruption.
Well, just in closing then, Pierre Spray, why is Obama giving us these lousy choices? Chuck Hagel, then Flournoy, who's even worse, and then Ashton Carter, who you've described as being appalling. So what's going on with Obama? He's not going to clean up the Pentagon, in other words?
Not a chance. I mean, imagine if he did. I mean, just stop and think. Think about what would be unleashed, the forces that would be unleashed, the amount of money that would attack him, you know, the propaganda, the increased slander, the attacks on his patriotism, all of that. You know, a guy who makes political calculations in his position as coldly as he does simply isn't going to take on the military-industrial complex. You know, why would he appoint a Secretary of Defense who will cause the roof to fall in on him? So there's not a chance that the U.S. will have a decent Secretary of Defense, and we haven't had one in a zillion years. You know, I mean, I've tracked very carefully every Secretary of Defense since 1960, and I know of not a single one who made any serious sacrifice for a matter of principle, with a minor exception of Melvin Laird, who was hardly a good Secretary of Defense, but, you know, he was a congressman who came in and under Nixon, but he did come in totally determined to wind down the Vietnam War, and he took some personal risks for that. He worked at it. Mm. He worked at it night and day. And he had enough stature that Nixon couldn't stop him from doing it. But that's the last Secretary of Defense I know that took any chances at all for a matter of principle. All the rest of them let the horrors of, exploding budgets, shrinking forces, ever more expensive weapons.
More toys and less boys, yeah.
Exactly, have let that roll. Not a single one has put a dent in it, and Laird included. The only thing he wanted to do was to get us out of Vietnam, and he took some risks for it, so I give him some credit, since nobody I know of since then took any chances for anything. The last few included Gates and Panetta. Good God, if there ever was a political hack, it's Panetta.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Pierre Spray.
Okay.
Again. Again, I've been speaking with Pierre Spray, who's a veteran high-tech defense weapons and systems designer, as well as a highly regarded producer of avant-garde jazz and other genre recordings. He was the primary designer of two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. He left the Pentagon in 1986 and went on to found Maple Shade Records. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the ideological underpinning of the obstructionists who have basically shut down the Congress and let the ship of state head for the fiscal cliff. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gary Weiss, a journalist and author of two books probing the underside of finance, Wall Street versus America and Born to Steal. He was an award-winning investigative reporter for Business Week, and his articles have appeared in Condé Nast Portfolio, Parade Magazine, Salon, and the New York Times, among other publications. His latest book is Ayn Rand Nation, The Hidden Struggle for America's Soul. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gary Weiss.
Hi there, Ian.
And Gary, it looks as if the Tea Party caucus have all but shut down the Congress. They have they're coming back on Sunday, apparently. That means, of course, that unemployment benefits won't be renewed, and the payroll tax isn't now in limbo. And it looks as if Bain has had to do this because he can't get the Tea Party to make any agreement before the so-called fiscal cliff deadline. And they won't. The Senate's basically handed them something they don't want to touch. My understanding is that the reason why Boehner can't get a deal, and he was humiliated recently when he tried to do his so-called Plan B by the Tea Party caucus, that the Tea Party types basically are going to let the government go off the fiscal cliff, because then they can come back after next Thursday, a week from today, and say, well, we're not dealing with tax cuts because the tax cuts will have expired. I mean, is it that kind of kabuki we're talking about?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, we're dealing with a completely insane situation in Washington. The public interest is simply, it just isn't even part of the dialogue, at least on the part of the Republicans. And, as I explained in Ayn Rand Nation, and I think a lot of it, this goes back to Rand, there is no concept of the public interest in Rand's ideology. And I think we're seeing that to a certain extent played out in Washington.
Well, it remains to be seen whether the public are going to be sufficiently appalled that they'll take some interest in politics and boot these guys out.
Yeah, that's 2 years down the road. We're stuck with them for 2 years.
Well, but what they seem to have shown, and I did an interview yesterday with the chief investigative reporter for Politico, who'd originally broke the story about Dick Armey's trying to recapture his organization, FreedomWorks, and coming in with a gun-wielding aide that escorted FreedomWorks' top employees off the premises. And then several of the women started to sob and broke down when Armey tried to suspend them, and he relinquished them. But 6 days later, on September the 10th, Armey was kicked out with a $8 million parachute, which was given to him by Richard J. Stevenson, a reclusive Illinois multimillionaire who's apparently an Ayn Randian, and he's a founder of the for-profit Cancer Treatment Centers of America. So it looks as though that these organizations, the real question is, how can anybody say that we're talking about ideology here when these organizations, particularly FreedomWorks, are so much about what's called AstroTurf? It's multimillionaires basically hiring congressmen to do their bidding.
Well, yeah, I think that's definitely what you have. But I think that you have to take a look, though, at the ideology of the multimillionaires, as you point out. You know, the ideology that these people have very largely adopted, and you know, you're seeing this sweep the country, is the Randian ideology. And it's a complex ideology that is designed to defend and to justify, to provide moral justification for greed and selfishness. And I think it's no accident that a man like Stephenson is, in fact, a Randian acolyte going back many decades.
Yeah, well, apparently he goes back to actually having gone to her lectures, right? Her seminars,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, he went to her seminars, and you know, he's a dedicated Randian. He's not that active on the Randian circuit, but he was co-executive producer of this horrific Atlas Shrugged movie that just came out recently that was panned universally. He was co-executive producer, which means that he put up the money for the movie. So he's definitely out there. He's he's willing to put his money into that bomb. You know, he's also willing to put his money clearly into FreedomWorks. You know, obviously they're both of a kind. They're both designed to advance the ideology, which you know, as you point out, it's selfishness. It's designed to advance the billionaires' interests, and that's why it's no accident that a man like Stephenson is very active in the Randian movement.
Well, I know an actor who was in that movie, Atlas Shrugged, and apparently the backers, the money man, and presumably it was this guy Stephenson, drove the poor director crazy because they were so literal about the text of Ayn Rand, as though it was the sacred scrolls, you know. And if it said in the thing that the main character was wearing a red tie, and if the actor showed up with a blue tie, they had to send him back to wardrobe to get a red tie.
Yeah, I mean, that's the irony of that movie. You know, it's supposed to be a commercially viable product. You know, these people are capitalists, and yet they made it impossible for an actual audience to enjoy the movie. So these are capitalists acting in a completely non-capitalistic fashion. You know, putting forth this propaganda.
Right. Well,
that no commercial value at all.
Well, but so let's try and pin this down then, Gary Weiss, again, journalist and author of two books, Probing the Underside of Finance, Wall Street versus America and Born to Steal, and he was an award-winning investigative reporter for Business Week, and his latest book is Ayn Rand Nation, The Hidden Struggle for America's Soul. So in trying to understand the ideological underpinnings of the Tea Party, now the people who back them obviously have what Clinton used to call a dog in this fight, don't they? I mean, they're the ones who benefit, the Koch brothers and Stephensons and others. They directly benefit from the kind of legislation. But how could this Tea Party organization that supposedly came out of outrage that was felt in the country about the bailout in 2008, how could they turn from right-wing populists into slaves of the oligarchs?
Oh, I think it was actually actually a natural progression. I think what you have is you did have a certain amount of grassroots dissatisfaction, but the people of the Tea Party became, I think, in effect, tools of these right wing oligarchs and tools of ideologues within their movement who were active in the Ayn Rand movement. I discussed that in my book, how people like Mark Meckler, who is also another very prominent Tea Party leader. He became leader of the Tea Party, of a different Tea Party organization. Actually, it's no accident, I think, that the Randians are so active with the Tea Party, either as financial backers or as leaders, because the whole point, really, of the Tea Party at this point, the way it sort of morphed morphed from, I think, sort of genuine outrage at bailouts, which I think a lot of us feel, into an effort to just get another right-wing political effort justify the perks of the ultra-rich. And the ideology of the ultra-rich is the Randian ideology.
So how does this tie in then with the libertarian wing of the Republican Party? If these are just a new rebranding of the far-right Republicans, or is there a new strain coming in there of the libertarians?
Well, I think what you're seeing is indeed a new strain. You know, the libertarians originated in the 70s. It was, in fact, almost a sort of a left wing movement in many respects. You know, the old the Brand herself called them the hippies of the right. You know, these are people who believed in freedom, and you know, I think we can all associate with that. Freedom to smoke marijuana, freedom to live the way you want. I mean, that's the libertarian movement in its pure sense, the way it originated in the 70s. But what you had was that the Rand movement, which, as I say, it's a complex philosophy, basically designed to justify greed and selfishness. The Rand movement began to sort of take over the libertarians to the extent that today the Cato Institute, which is a major libertarian think tank, was very recently taken over by a Randian ideologue named John Allison, who's a former chief executive of BB&D Corp, a very active Ayn Rand acolyte. So here you had a very serious libertarian organization going back many years is now basically almost a Randian organization. Now, the Randians and the libertarians used to be sort of at odds for various reasons, and now you're seeing that they're sort of merging, very slowly kind of merging, to the extent that now libertarians are just reflecting the ideology of greed of Ayn Rand.
Well, apparently that's what happened with this fellow that was reinstated in the coup after the failed coup of Dick Armey to take back his organization, where he came in with his gun-toting aide and tried to fire this guy, Matt Kibbe, and the other guy, Brandon. And apparently Matt Kibbe is a libertarian as well as a Randian, who is close to this fellow Stevenson, Richard J. Stevenson, the reclusive Illinois millionaire who's basically gave the $8 million golden parachute to Armey for him to get lost, you know. So that's two organizations that they've taken over, right? Cato and Freedom Works.
Yeah, in effect. I mean, Stevenson is not quite the Randian, the sort of very prominent Randian ideologue that John Allison is. John Allison is like a Randian thinker and author, as well as a retired CEO of this and financier of the Randian movement. But he's still nevertheless very prominent in the Randian movement. So now, yes, we have two Randian organizations in effect that don't appear on the surface to be Randian, but they are. Cato, the libertarian, and Freedom Works, the Tea Party organization.
And they've got at least one senator who's a Randian, right? Who happens to be called Rand.
Yeah, well, Rand Paul.
I mean,
the son of Ron Paul. Rand Paul is an admirer of Rand. But I think really the main Randian figure that you see on the political stage nowadays is Paul Ryan. The House Budget Committee chairman, former vice presidential candidate, who went to great lengths to deny his Randian connections when he was running for vice president. And it was just a pack of lies. I mean, he just simply tried to rewrite history. And his history was one of very strong devotion to Randian ideals. And he's now a House Budget Committee, back to being House Budget Committee chairman.
So is this these sort of movements that have merged? And I think actually there's the libertarians, the Randians, and then you've got, essentially you've got free market fundamentalists and religious fundamentalists also merging on the Republican right. So isn't that also a big component of it? Not just market fundamentalism, but religious fundamentalism?
Religious fundamentalism,
Though she was an atheist, right, Ayn Rand, I mean...
Exactly. She was an atheist, and this is where you get into a possible source of tension. You haven't really had too much of it. But a possible source of tension in the right is that, the Rand... And then this is the reason why Paul Ryan tried very hard to disassociate himself from Rand, is that Rand was a vehement atheist. And that's hard for, you know, for this is the reason why William F. Buckley Jr. was very opposed to Rand. You know, he was a Catholic, a practicing Catholic, and Rand was very anti-Catholic. And, it, you know, so, you know the Rand movement is so extreme. It is, in fact, you know, it's so extreme that it's actually atheist. You know, it has that trait, which repels a lot of people in the religious right, no question about that.
Well, and you said earlier that Ayn Rand described libertarians as right-wing hippies, is that right?
Yeah, that's what she referred to them as, the so-called hippies of the right, which had some validity. I mean, in the old days, they, you know, a lot of hippies, real hippies, in, you know, back in the 70s, you know, became libertarians. It was popular among young people back in the 70s. You know, there was an appeal to it, you know, freedom, and it was a certain purity to the movement, and it was a very intriguing movement back in the 70s. But Rand hated it. Rand hated libertarians, and you did see a certain amount of that tension between the Rands and the Randians and the libertarians over the years. But now they've sort of put that aside, and they've really gotten to be real chummy lately. And you know, this is what you're seeing.
So,
Plato Institute, Randian organization now.
Well, Gary Weiss, again, journalist and author of two books, Probing the Underside of Finance, Wall Street versus America, and Born to Steal. And he's an award-winning investigative reporter for Business Week and the author of An Ayn Rand Nation, The Hidden Struggle for America's Soul. So what's going on, though, in terms, you said that that young people were attracted to the libertarian movement during the 60s and 70s, the hippie period, right. And Ayn Rand called them the hippies on the right.
Yeah.
What about these young people that went down to the Republican convention down in Florida, campaigning for Ron Paul? They showed up in droves. Are young Americans being attracted to this selfish ideology?
Oh, well, there's no question that there's a lot of appeal, extremist, the extreme right, just as, you know, the extreme left to a certain extent has, you know, certainly appealed to young people trying to, who are experimenting with ideas. Ron Paul has had a lot of support among the young, a great deal of support among the young. This is just something that one has to sort of get used to. You know, extremist movements do, whether they're the left or the right, do tend to attract young people. Rand was very popular and is to this day very popular on college campuses. I just appeared on I just gave a speech at a college campus in Texas a couple of weeks ago, and my God, Rand is very strong in Texas, but you know, also in the Northeast, very strong, very popular.
So there's no such thing on the left, is there, as the kind of activism that the Tea Party represents, in as much as they've took over the Congress. They're the ones that seem to have the reins at the moment. They're the ones that are pushing the ship of state over the fiscal cliff for their own reasons. And they're also the mechanism of the fiscal cliff and the sequester was recreated by a Tea Party tantrum over the debt ceiling. And now the Secretary of Treasury says the debt ceiling has come back a month early. It's going to happen any day now.
Yep.
So they're able to blow the whole government up, and they've already caused the government to be downrated, its credit to be downrated. So they really wield a disproportionate amount of power. Why is there nothing like that on the left? The Occupy movement on the left basically wanted nothing to do with electoral politics, and after all, it was Karl Rove that organized these people in part, and the Koch brothers financed them along with the American Petroleum Institute to take over the Congress in 2010. So they know how to wield power, but is there anything on the left that's even comparable or nascent?
No, there is not. Unfortunately, the Occupy movement failed to organize. The Tea Party movement was very well organized from the beginning. They had, for example, they had FreedomWorks, which came in, you know, basically a Republican organization, came in and became a Tea Party organization. They had a better sense of organization. The Occupy movement was far too anarchic. Now, if the Occupy movement had gotten a certain degree, had gotten their organizational act together, they might be more of an influence now. And had they been able to get their organizational act together, well then, perhaps then they could have attracted some funding. They had no funding and no organization, whereas the Tea Party has organization, most of which is the most important thing, and they've got a ton of money from the Kochs and from the far right, a ton of money. I mean, look, an $8 million package, an $8 million severance package to Dick Armey? A phenomenal sum of money. It's like, you know, it's like a CEO's golden parachute. It's amazing. And how can you call that a grassroots organization when there's that much money being poured into it?
Right, and they poured all that money into in Stevenson, who paid off Army to get lost. He put up a ton of money for Joe Walsh, the Tea Party favorite, who lost to Tammy Duckworth, and Army was putting up money for the two senators who had major foot in the mouth problems. Murdoch in Indiana, who was defeated because of his remarks about women accepting children of as a result of rape as being God's will, and the other guy, Aiken, saying that the women, female body could shut down in the case of rape. So,
you know, and if you compare that to the Occupy movement, honestly, yeah, which was far closer to the way people actually feel in this country, and they had no money. I mean, they were literally begging for food in Lower Manhattan. And my wife brought down some food for them. I mean, they couldn't even get a meal, much less funding.
Sure.
It was pathetic. It's just pathetic.
Well, there has to be a way for people to rise above money and assert themselves. And I thank you so much for joining us here today, Gary Weiss.
It was my pleasure, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Gary Weiss, who's a journalist and author of two books probing the underside of finance, Wall Street versus America, and Born to Steal. He was an award-winning investigative reporter for Business Week, and his latest book is Ayn Rand Nation, The Hidden Struggle for America's Soul. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with Dina Racer about her article at Truthout, Slow Rolling Massacre Unfolds in the Shadow of Shocking High-Profile School Shooting Sprees. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dina Racer, who's a chief investigator of the Follow the Money Project and a partner at Bauman and Racer Group. For over 25 years, she has for over 25 years of experience in investigating and exposing defense procurement fraud, and for 10 years directed the Washington, D.C.-based Project on Military Procurement, a nonprofit organization that worked with whistleblowers and sources inside the Pentagon and defense industry, exposing fraud and waste. She's authored The Pentagon Underground and co-authored Betraying Our Troops, The Destructive Results of Privatizing War. And she has an article, Truth Out, Slow Rolling Massacre Unfolds in the Shadow of Shocking High-profile shooting sprees. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dina Racer.
Hi, nice to be on again.
And normally, Dina, we talk about your work in exposing fraud and waste in the Pentagon and in the military procurement system. And of course, we started out today with P.S. Bray, the designer of the A-10 and F-16, and talking about Chuck Hagel, who he thinks is a disaster. But an even greater disaster would be Michel Flournoy, who is also being touted, and Ashton Carter. So before we get into the fact that you've written this article, it's somewhat a departure from what you normally cover, which I really want to talk to you about. Any comments on the Hagel nomination?
Well, you know, at least Hagel has shown signs that he can be shamed into doing the right thing. He was not so hardcore that he didn't do a giant mea culpa in the gay issue, and the other thing, the guy's been to war. I mean, he knows it. You know, he's then I think the neocons just hate him because they haven't, and he has, and he knows that. And he, over the years, has become more and more concerned about the Pentagon, the waste, the committing of troops, the contractors, the ridiculous wars. And so, as my mentor, who worked in the Pentagon for 45 years, Ernie Fitzgerald, he would call him the best of a bad lot.
Okay. Well, let's then move to the reason I'm calling you, Adina, about this very moving article that you've written at Truth Out, Slow Rolling Massacre Unfolds in the Shadow of Shocking High Profile Shooting Sprees. And it's a personal perspective about a nation's shock and grief over a horrific act in a place where such things aren't supposed to happen. That's in Newtown, Connecticut, and the places where similar tragedies occur almost every day, where children grow up in a relentless tide of violence. Now, clearly what got you upset and it was the media response to what happened in Newtown, where so, and I saw this myself, it was appalling, where so many people in the media said, you know, this is the town is in grief. This is just not supposed to happen here, which leads you to ask the question, well, where is it supposed to happen?
That's right. And by the way, I should tell you that I mainly am working now as a columnist for Truth Out. I have a column called Solutions Making Government Work and do a lot of Pentagon. But this just struck me. I had, you know, I just had to do something because I was very proud of the fact that I live in El Cerrito, California, which is just, it's what I call a hybrid town. It's in between Berkeley and the University of California and Richmond, California, which is a very, very, one of the most dangerous towns in, there's really only, you know, it's almost like the Middle East. There's really only 5-10 miles in between all this. And El Cerrito is a small town, like Newtown. You know, we have a marching band and a debate team and a homecoming parade. But it's very multicultural. It's a, what I call a hybrid town. We have all economic stratas, all races. It's a, my high school that my kids went to was a majority-minority high school. So my kids, you know, my kids went through. I got to know kids from all different sizes. Some of my kids' best friends lived in a really scary part of Richmond. And I felt like, wow, I really understand living in a diverse society. But my youngest son decided when he was in middle school and beginning of high school to play for a California youth football team in Richmond, California. And anyone who wants to go to the article at Truth Out can look at the picture. And the picture is, says 1,000 words. He was the only white kid. And usually, and that wasn't as unusual in that situation, because usually there's Asians and there's Hispanics and there's, you know, and there's blacks and African-American kids, you know, the whole thing, Filipino, whatever. And when I took him for tryouts, he was 100% black. It was just 100% African-American kids. And the coaches, I got to know the coaches. And we were treated so well. I mean, I have to tell you, we were the only white couple sitting in the stands. And my son wore black under all his football clothing. So, and he was the center. So the only way time you could ever see that he was white is that he put out his day-glow white hand because he was the center, dyke the ball. So we got to see something that what I normally in my middle to upper middle class existence, I grew up in a complete lily white towns, Lexington, Massachusetts, and Kettering, Ohio, and you know, basically knew no minorities when I moved to California. But what really shook me was the killings that just were going on during this my short little dip into this, and it included one of the kids who had made it up to University of Oregon and had a, you know, was going to get a full football scholarship was shot dead 2 days before he left. And there were these kids on these teams. We had lots of strict discipline. They had to be tutored. But when the coaches had to let them go after football season, they couldn't keep hold of them all the time. And some of the kids actually shot each other from different neighborhoods. So finally, it was just the end of it is out of the three coaches, there was two brothers who were the assistant coaches, and they had really come basically out of the bad part, had done drugs and gone to jail and came back and made something of themselves and didn't want the kids, and the head coach. And one of the brothers got shot. partially for going back and trying to pull the kids out of the neighborhoods to get them into the Richmond Steelers. And so when they had the award ceremonies that year for the kids to graduate into high school football teams, the 14-year-olds, they all line up, and of course there's my Dayglo white kid son. But they had the mayor and the ministers and everybody there, and they went to each one of these kids and they prayed over them that they would make it to adulthood. And they prayed over my son, and I felt so guilty because I knew statistically my son had a very good chance of making it to adulthood, and a lot of these kids were at risk. And it just, I kind of went on with life. My kids have now just graduated from college and football and all that. And when I was sitting there watching that television, it just hit me like a knife. I mean, I literally screamed to the television, where is it supposed to happen? And then I realized this was a terrible tragedy that just knifed us all, and you know, in the heart and everything else. But just 5 miles from me was this slow-rolling massacre still going on year after year after year. And I saw you'd see it on the news and see it on a blip, and every time I'd see, you know, that some young man of 21 would be killed, I'd wince and think, gosh, was that one of those kids I knew on the team? And I went back to Coach Kalia, and Khalid, and he was the only surviving coach. The main coach also had died of cancer. And
they were working hard to keep these kids out of trouble. That was their
it just broke their hearts. You could just see that when his brother was killed, and then Coach Fred had cancer, which he was really kind of young. He's only 62, and he had, you know, the main coach. He had control of it, but the cancer just ate him up in 2 years, and so I had lost track of Khalid, and Khalid quit being a coach, and he has a foundation which really is not set up right, and he doesn't know what to do. But he makes enough money, and from 2005 to now, he has pulled 10 kids out of that quagmire and got them bachelor's degrees, while getting his associate degree now, and he's going to go get his own bachelor degree. And we talked about how we both grew up, and how this all worked, when he went to an El Cerrito school. All the same school district. When he was 6 years old, he had never talked to anybody white. He was like me, only at an earlier age. He had never had any exposure to anybody out of that neighborhood of his, and he was amazed that these kids all knew by sixth grade where they wanted to go to college and what they wanted to do. But he got put back into the school, the bad high school in Richmond, and he just knew he couldn't go to college. He wasn't the kind of guy that went to college. And it just struck me, and I finally, you know, at the end of the article said, I'm not going to sit around and do this anymore. I'm going to find Khalid, and I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to try. I might not be able to do a lot about it. It's huge problems. It's got a lot to do with, it's almost less with race now and more of economic disadvantage. And I said, I'm going to go in there, and I'm going to go out of my comfort zone, go back into Richmond, and see if I can help Khalid pull kids out. And now I'm going to have lunch with him on Sunday and write another column next Thursday about with my son, talking about what can we do about this.
And this, of course,
I had a little dip into it, and I could go back to El Cerrito, but I think about the people who live there with their kids year after year getting killed.
And this is happening 5 miles from your home in the town of Richmond, which is really where the Chevron refinery is. It seems to be dominating that. One of the most dangerous cities in California. And gun violence is so rampant that it's taken the lives of more than 900 of its citizens since 1990. And you're talking about what just happened in Newtown, Connecticut, where people in the media kept saying this is not supposed to happen here, which raised the question of where is it supposed to happen? And then the answer to this question is that it happens all the time in poorer neighborhoods across this country. Every day, young schoolboys and schoolgirls, too, to a lesser extent, yes, are shot down.
And it's painful to me because I'm now looking to write the next column. And the whole teddy bear and lighting a candle with teddy bears and laying them out in the street and stuff, just people driving hundreds of miles to do that is just drives me crazy because it really is, it's really not helping the parents, because the parents are just completely devastated. One of my best, dearest friends' son is a clergyman there, and he's going through his own living hell trying to help these families. But it's a way that makes them feel better. It's a kind of Martha Stewart way to make them feel better. And they have a fund for the families. And I understand that this is a terrible situation, and this is a terrible thing that happened to these families. And they've raised $3.5 million. But I have to think about, you know, that these families lived in this town because they were middle to upper middle class. And I don't really know what that money is going to do for that community that they don't already have. They already have grief counselors. They already got people volunteering. But what would $3.5 million do to someone like Coach Khalid to help pull kids out, get them in get them educations, bachelor's degrees, where they have a chance? Get them to understand, have leadership classes where they interact with other kids that are from other socioeconomics, and make them understand, yes, you can go to college. You can do this. You can get out of here. You can then make it better. You can make your, better kind of thing.
Well, Dean, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you.
Well, I'm sorry, Doctor. I'm so
No. I thank you for your article at Truth Out. Slow rolling massacre unfolds in the shadow of shocking high profile shooting sprees. Again, Chief Investigator of the Follow the Money Project, Dina Racer. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank producer Jose Benavides and Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.